Over the millennia, new instruments have emerged which have expanded the creative horizons of musicians. The whispers of the simple flute defined music for ancient civilizations, while the horn has been heard for centuries, from the battlefield to the opera house. But in the middle of the last century, a new instrument emerged which could replicate the voices of every instrument ever invented, and much, much more. I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd, and you're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. In this week's programme, I'm telling the story of the synthesizer, an instrument that opened a symphonic universe of sound. And while you might mistake it as merely a cousin of the electric organ, there's much more that a synthesizer can do.
What is a synthesizer is a very good question to explore. The only parallel I can find is to compare a computer. Would you say your microwave oven is a computer? Well, it uses a computer to function, but it's not flexible. My computer, I can program it to play a game. I can program it to write my email. I can program it to do beautiful pictures. A computer is an open palette and an option to go in different directions. And I would say a synthesizer has a parallel. In an organ, you could shape and control a sound. They might have had some knobs and switches, but it was always in a certain realm, a certain range of possibilities that an organ could do. It wouldn't let you stretch the notes in very strange ways. It wasn't designed for that. But a synthesizer, in its purest form, has the option to create any sound from low to high to bright to dark. It's not limited by a specific set of programming options. Pure synthesizer can do anything, can do any sound.
Music can now be produced entirely by electronics. No known instruments are involved. Coded information is punched out. An electronic music synthesizer does the rest.
While electronic music pioneers had talked of sound synthesis for decades, the electronic music synthesizer was the first instrument to use synthesizer in its name. It was built in the early 1950s by the American company RCA, already a giant in the entertainment industry. Electronic music historian Tom Ray.
RCA built radios. They had radio stations. They published records. They were involved in film. They were ubiquitous. RCA built the RCA synthesizer. Mammoth machine, 200 tons of air conditioning, filled up a room and a half. I had two paper tape mechanisms on the front that you would punch in the sounds you'd like to get out. That was essentially the first modern synthesizer.
Brian Kehue is a musician, producer, and music historian.
When synthesizers were built, like the RCA system, they were using valves and switches, simple circuits, to create a predetermined sound. It would be a certain pitch and a certain brightness. You can also specify timbre, the tone, the volume of a sound, and they could pre-program that on the RCA Mark I. RCA really wanted to make it an instrument that could replace musicians, and that we don't want to pay union session musicians in New York City to play their oboe per hour or per session, and that every time you wanted a new piece of music, you had to hire the arranger, the contractor, the composer. You've got an expensive process. And so with an electronic device, they could create music with just the composer.
I think AF of M, American Federation of Musicians, was ever vigilant about anything that would replace musicians. And so they started putting a lot of pressure on RCA. We're not going to do any recording for RCA if you go through. There were ways to put pressure. And basically, I think by that time the bloom was off the rose. I think some people in the organization realized, we're not going to make any pop tunes with this. They gave it to Columbia Princeton Studios.
The Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center was set up in the 1950s by Columbia University professors Vladimir Yusachevsky and Otto Luening, and Princeton University's Milton Babbitt and Roger Sessions. Based in New York City, It was the first academic research center dedicated to electronic music in the United States, and in its early years was focused on avant-garde experiments in tape music, a style they built on with the new RCA machine. Brian Kehoe.
They began to experiment with it. Now we can create sounds that are designed by us rather than modifying what we can record on tape. Putting it through filters and echoes and so forth, we can actually generate sound from scratch.
In 1957, the center took delivery of the all-new RCA Mark II synthesizer, but the music was hardly free-flowing.
It was so cumbersome, so slow to program and write these parts that not a lot of work could be done on it. Not quickly, not efficiently. It was not real time. If you didn't like the feeling of the last part of the piece, you had to rewrite the code and then have it play it through all again and say, no, it's still not right, let me do it again. And the pieces, I think, reflect that. It doesn't really have a spontaneity to it, but it really does have some new boundaries, new vistas of sound.
In 1964, the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center released an album showcasing some of the early works produced using the RCA Mark II. And it caught the ear of a young music student, Herb Deutsch, who had been exploring the emerging new field of electronic music.
One of my college professors just got the recording made by Columbia University. He said, you know what? Why don't you take it home and listen to it at home? I said, oh, absolutely. And took it home and I turned all the lights out in the house, played this LP of new sounding music and fell in love with it and was mystified by it. How did they create music that affected me differently than the music that I had already been listening to?
And it was investigating this new sound that Herb Deutsch came across an article in a magazine about how to build one of the earliest electronic musical instruments, the theremin. By chance, the author also had theremin kits for sale.
I almost immediately made a phone call to the phone number that was given, and a woman answered the phone, and I said, is this the Moog home? And she said, well, the first thing is, it's pronounced Moog.
Bob Moog, the man behind the theremin kits, had built his first theremin at the age of 14 and later developed kits to sell, which partly funded his graduate studies in engineering. And it was at a music convention where he was selling these kits that Bob Moog and Herb Deutsch got to meet face to face for the first time.
I met Bob in December 1963 and he was in a small room, a little booth where he was selling his theremins. I told him that I had bought one of his instruments and I told him that I was very interested in electronic music. And he and I had a conversation that ran probably 3 hours. No one came in. We were alone. And during that 3-hour conversation, we talked about what electronic music is and why is it interesting and different. We talked about the word synthesizer. And he said, well, synthesizer is the instrument that Columbia has. And I said, Bob, that is not a musical instrument. It's just a term. The word synthesize means to put music together. And I left him then. Within a week, he wrote me a letter, and I was doing a concert in New York City, and I told him about it. And he did go to the concert that I gave, which was in January of 1964. After that concert in New York, the concert was in Greenwich Village. And when you're in Greenwich Village, you go to an Italian restaurant, and that's exactly what we did. And at that restaurant, we talked about building a new instrument. That's where the first real conversations took place.
And it wasn't long before words turned into action, and Herb Deutsch made a trip to upstate New York, where Bob Moog had his workshop.
My wife and my 3-year-old girl went up to Trumansburg, and we camped and had a little cabin. My wife and my daughter must have been alone by themselves for a long time, because I just drove to Bob all the time and worked every, you know, during the day all the time. It progressed a lot. After those first 2 weeks, a lot on the telephone, believe it or not, because Bob, you know, and we're both in New York State. By the time the first basic prototype was completed, it was still in 1964. When I wrote the very first piece. I wrote it at Moog's shop, and that was Jazz Images, a Work Song in Blues. It is the very first piece that ever used the sounds of that very first Moog prototype instrument.
Bob Moog had built what became known as a modular synthesizer because it was made up of a number of discrete modules, all doing different things. At the center of its analog circuit was an oscillator, which created a sound signal. That sound could be patched through to different modules, rather like a telephone exchange, to alter the sound in different ways. Brian Keyhue is a former archivist for the Bob Moog Foundation.
The concept of pure synthesis is you're working from components of sound to build something that you want. So with a very few modules, and the very first Moog systems were simple sets of maybe 7 or 10 modules, each one did a certain function, like you have a fork and a knife and a spoon. Each one does its function. So these are the modules he made. One is for an oscillator. It continuously plays a pitch or a note. He had a filter to brighten or darken the sound. You could move them around. You could put this one first, that one second, and see what happens. You could even hook it up wrong. He didn't limit it and say, you cannot do this. And so you could create thousands of combinations of sounds. This is more than the RCA Mark II could do.
In 1964, Bob Moog presented an academic paper outlining his invention at the annual conference for the Audio Engineering Society. Titled Voltage-Controlled Electronic Music Modules, it attracted some attention and some customers.
At that event, a few people even came up and said, oh, I'd like to buy one of these. I'd like to order a custom set. So Bob was suddenly in business to make these new devices. And as he did it, he was taking input from the customers. What do you want? What do you need? The people with the thought to move forward, the people that needed to create new sounds, were largely experimental university composers. And in these early days, a synthesizer was the price of a car. Really, only universities could afford and embrace the synthesizer.
Around the same time when Bob Moog and Herb Deutsch were breaking new ground in developing the first Moog synthesizer, another composer was having his own epiphany when it came to the future of music, 4,500 kilometers away in San Francisco.
I thought, I'm at the moment in music as if I were in the moment back in the 16th century or the beginning of the printing press. And I have this idea, and that's a much bigger idea for my life in the future than playing the clarinet in the symphony orchestra or something like that. And maybe I can't do it, but I should give it a shot.
Morton Subotnick was already an electronic music pioneer. He, along with fellow composers Pauline Oliveros and Raymond Sender, had founded the San Francisco Tape Music Center during the early 60s, which became a hive of musical experimentation. But in order to take his music further into uncharted territories, Morton Subotnick went searching for someone with the right technical expertise.
I put an ad in the Chronicle, and it had to be very short because you were paying by the word. So it was something like, need electronic engineer to help make electronic music easel, something like that, because I had the painter as a metaphor. And we had a couple of people come, and it was a time that drugs were starting, and their eyes were sort of wandering around, and they were pretty out of it. And then came this sober guy, didn't talk much, and it turns out he was actually wanted to borrow a tape recorder, but he didn't say that. He told me who he was and what he did, and I just assumed he was answering the ad.
This unassuming man was Donald Buchler, a physics graduate of the nearby University of California, Berkeley. Don was also a composer who had taken an interest in tape music. After abandoning his PhD, he earned a living working for NASA, but joined forces with Morton Subotnick in 1963 and began working on a so-called electronic studio in a box. And from the start, Morton Subotnick had clear ideas about what he didn't want the machine to be.
What I began to realize as I began to work with it is that I didn't want a black and white keyboard because I didn't want any notion of music of the past. What I was writing for instruments was new music, but it was new old music. This is going to be new new music. This is a whole new thing. And we can start from scratch.
The first Buchla electronic music system, also known as the Series 100 or just the Buchla, was similar to Bob Moog's machine in that it too was a modular system. But the decision to abandon the traditional keyboard on the Buchla in favor of knob turning and touchpads was a significant cultural decision, setting it on a very different path to the Moog.
One of the tenets of what they did was to push the boundaries, to not even allow it to play Beethoven on it. You'd have to do experimental music, music with less boundaries, more wide-ranging tones, and the Buchla is capable of absolutely wild ranges of sound that other things at the time were not.
Housed within the San Francisco Tape Music Center, the Buchla began to attract the attention of other forward-thinking composers in the city.
I could go there for $5 an hour and play with the very first Buchla. And of course, nobody ever collected the money and nobody was there. And I could stay up all night and burn candles and just live there, basically. And that's what I did.
Suzanne Charney was a grad student studying composition at Berkeley and had first experimented with computer-generated music at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology over on the East Coast.
At that time, making music on the computer involved entering data on data cards and then to wait overnight while the data was calculated and collect a great big tape in the morning and hear your composition. So nothing was in so-called real time.
But with the Buchla, Suzanne Charney developed a very different relationship with electronic music.
I think you could call it love. The machines spoke to me. They seemed to be living, warm beings. You could interact with them. They responded. You did something, they did something, and you developed a relationship. And also, the world that opened up was just so complete. I didn't need to interest other performers to play my music. It was hard as a classical composer. You had to find musicians, then they didn't do it right, and it was, whatever. And here I was in a complete universe where I was in it while I was doing it.
Inspired by the infinite possibilities of the Buchla, Suzanne Charney began composing her first pieces, which she presented to her college professors over at Berkeley.
So my first piece I did at the San Francisco Tape Music Center, and I brought that to my graduate class in composition. When I brought that electronic music, we had to go to the theater to hear it because it was electronic. You couldn't just play it in the classroom. We went over to the theater. They turned on the big sound system. My heart was pounding. I was so thrilled. I listened to it. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And when it was over, my professor said, "Tell me one thing." I said, "Yes." He said, "Why did you bring us over here?" And so that's when I made a decision to just pursue this music on my own, finish my degree, and I went to work for Don Buchla.
Meanwhile, Morton Subotnick's fortunes were more favorable. He switched coasts and took up a role as artist in residence at New York University and secured his first record deal around the same time. And in the summer of 1967, he released Silver Apples of the Moon, written entirely on the Buchla.
When I made Silver Apples, I was suddenly had to do what I was talking about. I had to make a new music. I had the slightest idea what that meant. Not the slightest. I had so much music in my head. How do I do something as if I didn't have that in my head? I just played with the machine 10 hours a day, 6-7 days a week for 13 months.
The album was a surprise hit, earning critical acclaim and decent sales too. Suddenly, people were waking up to the sound of the synthesizer.
Silver Apples was a big hit, so I was suddenly all over the place. And I was doing a lecture demonstration tour of Kansas. I was there for about a week. Everywhere I go, the place was jammed. I mean, the people were running down the hall to get to the room. At one point, I stopped someone. I said, where are you going? And she said, oh, I'm going to this lecture about electronic music. And I said, oh, you know electronic music? Oh, I love electronic music. I thought she was talking about Silver Apples of the Moon. I thought, that's pretty good. Oh, what did you hear? She said, oh, it's great. It's called Switched on Bach.
In 1968, Switched on Bach was a smash hit. Performed on the Moog synthesizer by the composer Wendy Carlos, it would become the biggest selling classical music album of the year, earning 3 Grammy Awards. And in turn, it proved a massive breakthrough in bringing the sound of the synthesizer into the mainstream. Brian Kehew.
It took the Switched on Bach record to really create a tonal, recognizable, traditional music version of synthesizer-based music. So people recognized, well, this is as valid as a pipe organ, this is as valid as a piano, as a real instrument.
The album was an international success and proved inspirational to one young artist who would later go on to become a synth legend in his own right, Rick Wakeman.
Suddenly here was somebody who was actually playing music that you recognized on sounds that you'd never heard before. And I just thought this was absolutely remarkable. I got Switched on Bach as a Christmas present. I remember playing it, and just, there was a bit of information on the back. And that's when I first really heard about Bob Moog.
The success of Switched on Bach meant it was the Moog which set the blueprint for what a synthesizer was in the public's mind, and what synthesizer music could and should sound like.
It wasn't even new old music, it was old music played on a new instrument. So there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's great. Bach is great, one of my favorite composers. The problem with it, to me, was if that was the model that people were going to get, we were going to be stuck with a long time before people started getting in the other way. Silver Apples came out a year before. It had a chance to make its little impact. And for sure, it didn't make the impact that Switched on Bach or Moog made.
Coming up, how the world's biggest bands fell in love with the sound of the synthesizer as it inspires new genres of pop music. And the synth is downsized as Japan's electronic giants enter the scene. That's on A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason, coming up after the news. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. This week, I'm telling the story of the synthesizer. By the end of the 1960s, music fans were becoming accustomed to the swirling modern sounds of the synth, thanks to the pioneering work of Bob Moog and Don Buchla. But with its rising popularity, new and important companies began to enter the market, including Oberheim Electronics in California and ARP Instruments, which was based in Massachusetts. And there were even more outside the USA.
Putney, where Peter Zinoviev has a hobby which is strictly for boffins. He keeps it in his garden shed, and it's called Digital PDP 8/S. Yes, it's a computer, and it has a hobby too, composing music.
Peter Zinoviev was a mathematician whose job was to work out how many people in Britain would be killed in the event of a nuclear war. Demoralized by this rather depressing day job, in the 1960s he opened an electronic music studio in a shed situated on the banks of the River Thames in London.
I gave up a well-paid job in order to do it. And the mechanism for this was, at that time, there was extremely high taxation on joint incomes. And my wife had a private income. And so my well-paid job was taxed at over 90%. And so it really wasn't worth doing and gave me, I suppose, a freedom to do whatever I wanted.
Although housed in a shed, the studio was a state-of-the-art facility, which even had a computer, a rarefied luxury in those days, which Peter Zinoviev could only afford after selling off the family jewels, literally.
This computer, PDP-8S, made by Digital Equipment Corporation, cost £4,000. A gigantic thing. We sold my wife's useless tiara, which she never wore or would dream of wearing, for exactly £4,000.
But while Peter was spending a lot on his studio, it wasn't earning him much.
Studio was very expensive. I had to do something about it, and then I thought of why not make something which is commercially viable. Vince met Tristram Cary, and I knew David Cockerell. We three formed a company called EMS, Electronic Music Studios, and decided to make an electronic music instrument.
The first EMS synth was called the VCS3, sometimes known as the Putney, and was at the experimental end of synthesizers. It could be used with or without a keyboard, and also had a small joystick, which was particularly effective at bending its unique sounds.
We also then started to promote, agitate, or something about electronic music in Britain, and people started to come. Paul McCartney of Ringo Starr, I tried to teach him VCS3, and then there was Moody Blues, King Crimson, who? Huge lot of people actually came. Because it was really not basically a pop instrument, it was an experimental instrument. So it was experimental pop groups who were keen on it. Pink Floyd, of course. I got to know them better than many.
With regards to my band, Pink Floyd, the VCS3 was certainly a key bit of kit, and is perhaps best known for its use on our album Dark Side of the Moon, where it features heavily on tracks like On the Run. As a band, we were always keen to get our hands on any new synth we could find, be it an EMS, Moog or an ARP. And it wasn't just us. From the day Bob Moog revealed his first modular synth, the giants of rock and roll stood up and took notice. Music producer Brian Keyhoe.
It was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Birds, the Monkees, people like that saw this instrument and said, we want one. And in these early days, a synthesizer was the price of a car or two, an automobile or two would be the same range. If we extrapolate that to today, you can imagine how expensive that type of instrument was.
While bands were using synths more and more in the studio, they were in turn looking to take them on tour, which proved to be another major hassle. At the Moog Company, ideas for a smaller, more convenient instrument began to emerge.
The synthesizer became an accepted studio instrument, an accepted touring instrument, and so people realized that this sort of, difficult to operate patching system could be condensed down to the most basic, useful functions. People that worked at the Moog Company actually were pushing for this, mainly because it would be less expensive. Originally, Bob was not interested in that idea. He was saying, we make Rolls Royces, we don't make Volkswagens.
While his company sold beautiful, bespoke and expensive synths to the world's music superstars, they were also expensive to make, and that left little in the way of profit.
It is not an apocryphal story that Bob Moog left Trumansburg on a trip and expressly told his engineers, I don't want you to develop anything while I'm gone. Well, they did anyway, because they knew it's either do that or not have a job. And Bill Hemsath put some Moog modules in a box that became the Model A Mini Moog. And when Bob Moog came back, he was very angry. I'm told he marched up and down in front of all the engineers and gazed at their shoes and so forth. He just didn't have that much interest in a massive commercial product.
However, perhaps to save the fortunes of his company, Bob Moog was convinced to carry on with the machine first developed by his engineers, and eventually the prototype Model D was ready to bring to market. And the Mini Moog, as it became known, was released in 1970. The Mini Moog was exactly that, a downsized version of the original modular Moog, all housed in a single compact machine with a built-in keyboard. Certainly, Bob Moog had to compromise on its build, but convenience and cost was its real selling point.
It starts to lose some of the capabilities of the first system, quite a few in fact. It's a fraction of what it could do, but they found over and over again people wanted to do the same things. They wanted simple sounds that were easily done. That was what a live performer, a studio musician wanted, was a very basic instrument. So the synthesizer became scaled down and less capable, but therefore more popular. Anytime something is reduced in price alone, it becomes more popular.
Still not cheap. They sold for around $1,500 even back in 1970. The release of the Mini Moog meant synthesizers had become much more accessible, especially for up-and-coming bands. Mark Mothersbaugh is a founding member of the band Devo.
Some people I knew, they were football players, and so we really didn't have anything in common, but they were football players who went to Vietnam, took drugs, killed people, got screwed up over the whole thing, and came back to Akron, Ohio. And they wanted to start a band, but none of them played instruments. And they told me if I would be willing to write music, they would buy me some equipment that I could use. I said, that works for me. So in that process, I got a very early Mini Moog, one of the first. I remember driving from Akron, Ohio to where his first factory was, Robert Moog, and it was an old barn. When we pulled up and I looked inside and barn doors were open and there were stacks of Mini Moogs in the process of being manufactured, I thought I'd just walked into a spaceship or something. A spaceship shaped like a barn. The Mini Moog became my M1 rifle. I mean, to this day, I can put on a blindfold. You could pick any sound of any of our songs where I use, you know, like a ray gun, like from Space Girls or something. I know that synthesizer inside and out, because after rehearsal, I took it home and it sat in bed with me and I kept playing it all night, every night.
The Mini Moog became a ubiquitous sound in music during the 1970s. Its versatility helping to define brand new genres of music, spurred on by the synthesizer sound. Nick Rhodes plays keyboards in Duran Duran.
Kraftwerk really was the big breakthrough for me. It was Autobahn from Kraftwerk was the first album that I really heard, and I bought that album. And it felt so modern and different than everything else out there. And then when I heard the song I Feel Love by Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer, that really changed my universe. And I think certainly I wasn't alone in thinking that this was the future of music. The Mini Moog, still one of the best synthesizers of all time.
But for all its success, the Mini Moog had one major drawback. It was monophonic, meaning you could only play one note at a time. Companies such as Yamaha, Roland and Oberheim had made synths which could play multiple notes, but they were limited in their size and sound range. But in 1979, the game was about to change, and prog rock legend Rick Wakeman was among the first to find out.
This guy came up to me, and I can remember lying on a sort of a sunbed with a drink or something, and he just sat down and he said, can I show you something? And I said, yeah. Got this huge sheet of paper, opened it up and it was like a big circuit board. I don't understand any of that kind of like. He said, what do you think? I said, well, I'll colour it in. I've got a clue what this one means. He said, I'm making a synthesizer. I said, oh yeah, are you? I want to be like a polyphonic Mini Moog. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah. Now, that is interesting. I said, that's really what everybody sort of wants.
A polyphonic synth has the ability to play more than one note at a time, which in turn means you can play chords, as on a piano. And the man who wanted to build one was a young Silicon Valley software engineer called Dave Smith. Dave had himself bought a Mini Moog back in the early 1970s and had developed a sideline building and selling accessories for it.
The first big accessory I built was a sequencer. I wanted to get one of the Moog sequencers, but they were very expensive, so I decided to build my own. So it just makes it very easy to set up rhythms and very precise repeating loops of sounds. Then one day I realized, well, if I like this, maybe other people would too. So I started a company called Sequential Circuits to sell them. And I think I sold four of them. So it was a raging success.
Undeterred, Dave Smith carried on developing add-ons for the Mini Moog, and Sequential Circuits began to grow.
There was, of course, a pent-up desire from myself, as well as everybody else, to be able to play chords on a synthesizer. Because if you're a keyboard player and you walk up to something that has a keyboard on it, the first thing you do is try to play a chord. But on these synthesizers, only one note would sound. So I just decided to go for it. Started early spring of 1977, right about when I quit my day job, and started working on what became the Prophet 5 that we announced the following year in January.
The Prophet 5 was so called because it was possible to play five notes at one time, a number dictated by money rather than musicality.
Basically, every note you hit has to have its own set of circuitry. So the more voices, we call them, you have, the more expensive it gets. So if you have two, it costs twice as much as a monophonic synth. If you have five, it's five times as much. So you have to limit it to hit some sort of reasonable price point. I think the initial price was $4,000, and then it went up to $4,500. But you have to remember, back then, you could buy a new car for $2,000.
Despite this eye-watering price, the Prophet 5 went down a storm when it was revealed to the world in January 1978.
We went to the NAMM show, National Association of Musical Merchandisers, twice yearly trade show for all musical instruments. So we just showed up and had a very small booth and brought the only working Prophet 5 that was barely working at the time, but enough to get through the show. And we could tell pretty quickly that we had blown everybody away and this was going to be a big change for the whole industry. We got approached by both Moog and Arp, who, of course, were saying, well, you know, if you want to work together on something, maybe we should talk. And, of course, we didn't. And that just kind of reaffirmed that we did have something unique. Everybody wanted one.
Nick Rhodes from Duran Duran.
For me, if you plot the line of the rise of the synthesizer right from Bob Moog onwards in, you know, mid-60s, the bit that changed even more dramatically, where the chart goes upwards at an extreme curve, is really when polyphony came in, because then it had come of age, it had become a legitimate instrument, it opened up the canvas, everything went widescreen.
But what set the Prophet 5 apart from earlier polyphonic synths is that it also solved another problem, which had been driving synth players mad, especially when playing live. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
In the 70s, I was used to being the lead singer, and while I was singing a song, I'd be thinking, like, between the verse and the chorus, I could get over to the Mini Moog and I could start working on the setting for the next song. Because we didn't talk between songs, we would just, like, let a song end and then we'd start the next one. I remember I thought, programs and memory, that's a godsend.
The other breakthrough of the Prophet 5 was that it was programmable. Its built-in memory meant players would no longer have to rely on written lists or bits of tape stuck all over their synth to remember settings for specific songs. Dave Smith.
You're able to store 40 different sounds that you could access by hitting a single switch. That took, I think, 1 kilobyte of memory, which was a lot. Back then, a kilobyte of memory, it was actually 8 different parts to get 1 kilobyte. Plus, this memory had to be backed up by battery power so that when you turn the unit off, it didn't forget.
The success of the Prophet 5 brought a wave of polyphony to the world of synthesizers, and soon every manufacturer had one on the market. But analog synths still had their flaw. In particular, the oscillators, which generated their sound, couldn't always be relied on for pitch-perfect performance, as Rick Wakeman found out when he performed an open-air concert in London.
They pick up radio frequency, and if there's aerials on the roof, it'll just completely throw the oscillators, and sometimes you'll actually get them coming through the synth. When I played Crystal Palace on a Saturday afternoon outdoors, pounding through the PA system was the football results. Arsenal 3, Aston Villa 2, Blackburn Rovers 2, Bolton Wanderers 2. And I think we finished with Stenhouse Muir 2, Morton 6 or something, and then we just started playing.
During the early 1980s, computerization was becoming more common, and the use of digital processing to make synth sounds was gradually taking over from the old analog electronics, which had been in use since the 60s. Dave Smith.
That all changed in 1983 when Yamaha came out with a product called the DX7. This was a totally digital instrument, and this instrument had a number of things that made it stand apart. First of all, it was all the way up to 16 voices, whereas the analog synthesizers got up to 8, but because every voice cost money, it was price prohibitive to go much beyond that. If you're digital, it costs the same amount to do, 4 or 8 or 16. It's just a matter of how fast your processors are. So, we sold maybe 6 or 7,000 Prophet 5s. They sold over 200,000 DX7s.
The success of the Yamaha DX7 was symbolic of a power shift taking place, as the pioneering companies started to struggle in the face of strong competition from Japanese companies like Korg, Roland, and Yamaha. The Japanese specialized in easy-to-use push-button synths, which came loaded with tons of preset sounds that were easy on the ear. They were cheap, too, meaning anyone with ambitions of starting a band could afford one. And sales went through the roof.
A few years later, after the DX7 in 1987, Korg came out with a product called the M1. And this is based on a different technique called sampling. With a sampling instrument, you actually take a real recording of a real piano, and then they shrink it down and assign it across the keyboard, so when you play the keyboard, you're actually playing a real piano and real strings and real everything. So that ended up selling even more than the DX7. The M1, I think, is probably historically still the most popular synthesizer ever made, and they sold a 250,000 of them or something. Moog went out of business, Oberheim went out of business, Sequential went out of business. We all disappeared at about the same time in the mid to late 80s because we just didn't make that change quickly enough.
During this time, the synthesizer gained more voices and more features and was more popular than ever. But for all its success, the synthesizer had arguably lost something too. Synths were originally created to generate an infinite number of sounds, but now everyone was beginning to sound the same, as the art of true synthesis was diminished.
We've gone from the open options of infinite sounds to something with easily operated buttons that says flute and oboe, because that's what a lot of people wanted. And those were very successful instruments. So we've been kind of cursed with the fact that the comfortable, successful instruments that got used on so many records and on so many tours were the limited, castrated, if you will, version of a synthesizer, and we end up with the same synthesizer sounds over and over again. People had lost the concept of exploring the many, many options that were previously available in the 60s.
And it was something musicians started to notice too. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
There were a lot of great synths that came out, but it's like the sounds that the technicians back in, in the factories for all these different companies were coming up with, they started becoming the go-to sounds, and it became so apparent that you'd watch MTV and you go, Jupiter 6, Jupiter 8, patch 21-2. You'd know all this stuff just because you'd heard the sound before.
Perhaps for a while, synthesizers became too clever, too perfect, and manufacturers lost sight of the fact that great music is often made through exploration. We don't need everything handed to us on a plate. And certainly, this century, that's something people are beginning to rediscover in synthesizers.
We went through what I call the digital dark ages. For 20 years, all anybody used was basically the same product because that's really all they wanted. As somebody who was designing instruments meant to generate new sounds and unusual sounds, it just wasn't that interesting. You know, if you want a piano, go buy a piano. But there's something magic, I think, about analog specifically. In fact, it's probably more popular now than it was in the 70s and the 80s.
An analog revival has emerged this century as artists and producers who came up in the digital era rediscovered machines which for a time had fallen out of fashion. Hip-hop producer DJ Jazzy Jeff.
I went down the rabbit hole of everything that I hear in a sample, I want that. So, okay, here's Kool & the Gang's Summer Madness. What is that that is playing that synth line? Oh, it's an ARP, Odyssey. Okay, I gotta find an ARP Odyssey. I found an ARP Odyssey for $100 in a pawn shop. You know, now they're $3,000 because they're in such high demand, but a lot of my old keyboards, you know, I was going into stores like, hey, you got a Mini Moog? And the guy would be like, what do you want that for? And I'm like, oh man, I just want some, oh, well, you know, give me $150. You know, to realize that now they're $5,000.
Many of the old analog synths cost more today than they did when they were first released, which has put companies like Moog and Sequential Circuits back in business. In turn, there's a plethora of new companies producing cheap, accessible analog machines, including modular synths, meaning musicians have a greater choice than ever.
I don't believe in the word replacement. I think of the word addition. I hate it when somebody says, oh, this is new, let's replace that. No, it hasn't. It's just a new addition. So I think there's room for everything, and every musician and every player, every writer has a different approach. And the Brooklyn approach is a very good one if that's the route that you want to go down. For other people, it's the keyboard route. For other people, it's the computer route. And I think that's the great thing about a lot of young keyboard players now. They're discovering a lot of the old synths, and they're playing around with them and finding things that they could do that to some extent we never did because, oh, we're on to the next one now.
Pioneers like Bob Moog and Don Buchla wanted to create an infinite choice of sound which would stretch the limits of an artist's imagination. Today, it's hard to imagine music without them, be it pop music, dance music, rock or hip-hop. The synthesizer has provided a new chapter of musical creativity, and we're still only a few pages in. Nick Rhodes from Duran Duran.
I like the physicality of synthesizers, and I like being able to turn dials and push sliders up to feel the sound almost. So when guitarists play guitars, you can bend a note or you use your whammy bar or you turn it up or down a little. Synthesizers all have their own personalities, and you really got to tame them and find out what they like and how they like to be used and get the best out of them. They're all so different. They're like people. No, I don't speak to them, but I wish I could, I wish.
Next week, the story of samplers and drum machines.
Suddenly there was like a new language. You can make sound effects into music. And I would lie in bed at night thinking of what we could do with it.
We weren't looking for real drum sounds. We were looking for something that was electronic, which was futuristic. It became the signature of Detroit techno.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The program was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith and James Beard. The editor is Jasper Corbett. This program was made in association with the Open University.